I'm very pleased to welcome back to you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University here in Fremantle. Hello, Martin.
It's great to be here as always.
Well, Martin, there's a lot going on in the world. We've been tracking it for some months ever since the US started bombing Iran and Israel started bombing Lebanon, amongst other places. And in a strange sort of way, Martin, it all feels rather normal now. I'm starting to get used to living in this time of bombing and tension and wars. What about you?
Sadly, that's probably the case, especially Israel bombing Lebanon. I think that's just become very normal. And this sort of this we are in war, aren't we? Situation with Iran and the US now is becoming normal as well. And we saw actual conflict break out again just this past week. So that's disturbing, given, we had all these assurances from Trump, didn't we, a week ago that an agreement was imminent. That doesn't appear to have turned out.
Well, not only that, but Lebanon, or at least the government of Lebanon, which isn't necessarily the government of Hezbollah, seemed to have struck an agreement in Washington, D.C., with Israel to stop whatever was going on. But of course, Hezbollah has announced overnight that they're not supporting any such agreement.
None of that really surprises me, because they weren't included in the negotiations or the discussions, yet they're the ones fighting the Israelis. So it doesn't really make sense if you ask me. They would need to be party to any agreement. And the agreement calls for them to disarm, which I don't think they're ever going to do unless they get something in return. And so I think that agreement's probably doomed before it starts.
It's going to be something that my granddaughters will be, in a sense, living with, Martin, reflecting on, wondering what their poppy thought about it all. Well, ever since 1948, when the Nakba happened, Israel came into being, Palestinians were pushed out. The tensions have been there, and it was said, as we've reflected many, many episodes ago of you from the Roundhouse, that this was going to be worked out of the barrel of a gun, was recognised by the Israelis from the very beginning.
There's never going to be a resolution to this without a comprehensive peace process, and it won't be resolved by bombing anyone to smithereens or even by occupation. So it's transpired in Lebanon, where you might have occupation, you've had again more bombing, etc. But without some comprehensive deal, I can't see this ending.
Yeah. Martin, while all that's happening, the US Congress is still contemplating somehow to halt the Iran war by taking away, or I suppose taking away is the right word, right phrase, President Trump's powers to continue to wage war there. The US House voted to halt the Iran war the other day. Some Republicans came over to their side, but it's not so easy getting everything through the Senate.
Well, even the fact that the House voted for it is quite significant, because despite lots of argy-bargy and disagreement between Democrats and Republicans all the time on most things, it's unusual for a Congress to not support a war that a president is involved in. Because after all, you're talking about the national interest. But I think that shows just how divisive this war is, that the Democrats have been against it almost since day one, and are critical of it. And the fact that you actually had a House of Congress vote to limit the US presidential powers, and the fact that you had some Republicans, only four, but some, side with those Democrats to get this through. Now, it's been knocked back in the Senate, which you'd expect, given the numbers and the personnel there. But I still think there's a symbolic victory, at least for critics of that war.
It really is interesting, isn't it? As you say, the Democrats against it from the beginning. It was emblematic of the fact that this new president in his second term believes that actually all power resides with him, and the notion that there's a separation of powers between the Congress, him and the courts, is something that Trump doesn't seem to think or worry too much about. Mind you, Martin, the way the Israelis are just running their own war and trying to bomb the smithereens, as you've said, Hezbollah and any dissident forces to be found in Lebanon or anywhere else around them for that matter, including continuingly in Gaza. Is it worried? It must have driven Trump to distraction. He apparently had a crazy phone call with Netanyahu, and some expletives were not deleted.
This was an extraordinary report and a real scoop that they got this call. And it's not really been denied by either Trump or Netanyahu, because they played down its impact. But this is a robust exchange where Trump basically says to Netanyahu, "Everyone hates you and you're an idiot." So something to that effect, basically. Look, the problem is, I mean, Trump's unpredictable, but Netanyahu is just running his own race here. And there's no way you can get a peace deal with Iran or seek to, I mean, Trump's leverage in the US is largely because he's got some leverage over Israel, who's a major actor. And if he doesn't have any leverage over Israel, then it undermines his capacity to do all sorts of things. So I can see his frustration, because he's actually sided with Netanyahu on lots of things. But Netanyahu doesn't appear to be willing to play Trump's game. This could get a lot worse before it gets better, because if you have an agreement between US and Iran and Israel just ignores it and keeps bombing Iran, we're going to have an utter mess. So watch that space.
Martin, I have a sneaking suspicion that Netanyahu and all those who follow him are never going to change their approach. Going back to what I observed earlier, Israel, on one view, a righteous view, know that they're going to be under attack for the next 50 years. So they're not going to do anything which seems to be a sideways or a backward step, or possibly to weaken their position when they need to be strong in 5 years, 10 years, 25 years, 50 years. So they're just going to keep stretching the friendship with the US to the absolute limit, believing that the US will not abandon them at any time.
That's a reasonable sort of view and set of assumptions, because there's a part that certainly Netanyahu's view is that these guys are our enemies, they'll always be our enemies. And so what we do is degrade their capacity as much as possible, and we've got an opportunity to do so. Of course, there is another view, and if I'm an Israeli citizen, I'm wondering, how do I be truly safe? How do I be truly go about my life? Well, I can only do that if my country's made peace with its enemies. So without peace, I mean, you can build a giant wall like they did. You can blow a lot of things up, and you can degrade capacity. Capacity comes back sooner or later. It's only a temporary thing. Without a peace agreement, you're never truly safe. And I think that's one of the biggest critiques of Netanyahu, is that despite all of the aggressive military moves up to October the 8th attack, Israel still was never safe. And if you speak to people in Israel, they still have to cower in nuclear shelters, bomb shelters, I should say. So I don't think you're ever safe while you're at war.
I mean, the usual and an appropriate retort to this is that bodies like Hezbollah, who won't sign up on their present agreement, are sworn to wipe out the state of Israel.
Yeah. So while ever that's there, you're never truly safe. And I'm not suggesting that, their job is just to capitulate entirely to the enemies, but surely some willingness to come to some kind of longer term agreement is the best long term approach. I'm a bit cynical of Netanyahu, because I know he's facing all these domestic charges at home, and I just wonder sometimes whether he actually truly wants a peace agreement, Michael.
Could be stretching it out, you think, Martin?
Yes.
Well, Martin,
Yes.
someone who's, it seems, is prepared to talk and resolve differences is President Zelensky of Ukraine, who I think wants once again to sit down with Putin and talk. Did you see that Ukraine aren't sitting back taking all of the hits? They actually had drones hitting St. Petersburg, the famed St. Petersburg, the other day. They're not taking it lying down, Martin. But is there any chance that they will sit and talk, or is Putin one of those guys who sees even being put in the same photo as someone like Zelensky as a complete back down from his strong position?
It was a fascinating development, seeing drones from Ukraine attack St. Petersburg nonetheless. Putin's hometown, one of the glamorous, most glamorous cities in Russia, right
The cruise
on the
ships go in there, Martin.
it's astonishing. It does show, that the capacity of Ukraine is, and it's how it's extending, extending, extending. But to your question on Putin, Putin will only agree to an end in the conflict if he's got a discernible win that he can take back to his people. And I think that's where the sticking point is. Is it territory? Is it other commitments around security in Ukraine, not joining NATO, not joining the EU, all of those things? He's got it, having enmeshed himself that this far, lost that many lives, and he's got it. He can't actually walk away without something to show for it, which is part of his problem.
Well, Martin, I imagine in all the military schools, including at places like Duntroon, where all our next generation of military leaders will be attending to classes, they'll be studying these approaches to war. We had Putin saying he was going to basically clean up Ukraine in a couple of days. He didn't expect the war to last more than two or three. And we had virtually the same language out of President Trump when he started bombing Iran. He expected them to concede and give up within a few days. It's happened in neither place. It tells us something about modern warfare, does it not?
Well, there's a saying that some military strategists have, in that if you're going to go to war, you deploy overwhelming force towards a very defined, specific objective. And both Putin and Trump here, I think, have really missed that advice, if indeed it holds, because they've both bitten off a lot. And in neither case can you see an easy resolution.
Well, this is where our military leaders do have a responsibility to speak truth to power when it comes to talking to the political leaders. It might be itchy to press a button, drop a bomb, fire a gun, send a torpedo from a nuclear-powered submarine to tell them what the rules of war are and how things can go terribly bad. But warfare is not just using military hardware. Martin, it can be imposing tariffs. Did you see that the US announced new tariffs over apparently, quote unquote, forced labour concerns, including on Australia, pushing it up to 12.5%?
Now, this was an interesting move. If indeed the US was genuinely concerned about forced labor, and this was the sole reason, the main reason why they'd imposed tariffs, not that I think tariffs work, but that would be an interesting development, and it would show, definitive interest in human rights, Michael. And Australia does, we're not free of forced labor. There are some issues there. However, almost universally in the US at least, and in other parts of the world, this is seen as an alternative device to impose tariffs because the original device didn't work and was struck out by the Supreme Court. So that's the way this has generally been seen. And to be fair to the Trump, I don't think he's really denied it. I've seen no discussion about actually forced labour practices in Australia that's emanated, Michael, which I think is rather curious about this. Everyone sees this as a matter of expediency.
A complete ploy. The interesting question is if someone were to take this to the Supreme Court, whether somehow or another the Supreme Court would feel incapable, unable to question the good faith of the president. There seems to be a new doctrine which is underlying all of the attempts to change the electoral map in the US to presume good faith on the part of the legislature when they come in and wipe out a black district and mess it all up. Well, if you presume good faith in the act or the president in changing the tariff regime, well, then maybe this is enough.
Well, I mean, I'm by no means an expert on this, but probably they've thought this through. And this, on the advice they've got, Michael, is their best means of getting this through based on the precedents that they have. So it's a very clever device. It's imposed despite the fact that they have a trade surplus with Australia. And despite the fact that it's been shown already when it was imposed to increase prices in the US at the expense of consumers.
Well, the funny thing is, not that I'm close to it, but Australia has, and there's been large organisations pushing at human slavery questions, and large organisations here have to be able to verify that trade deals they're doing, supply arrangements they have, don't involve human slavery, Martin. You'd think that Australia could satisfy anyone pretty much in the world that we're good guys.
Certainly, you would hope so. But I think that it's been interesting hearing reports from the Anti-Slavery Commissioner that demonstrate there's still some issues here. We're not free of that, and particularly when it comes to our supply chains and where we get our materials from. You're dead right. Every organisation, I think it's a turnover of about 500 million, or there is 100 million. I have to go back and check my facts, Michael, but there's a minimum turnover requirement, and all large companies need to look into this. So, that's a start, but clearly it's still happening in Australia.
One assumes that our friend Elon Musk, and having all of it, the Teslas made in China, or so many of them, including mine, made sure that there wasn't a group of Uyghurs in a virtual prison camp way out in the back of China making important parts for the Teslas, Martin.
No, well, I think that's a real issue. And it's an issue certainly in a lot of car manufacturing, a lot of the materials that we get from China, et cetera. And they're our biggest trading partner. And if you look at all the EVs coming in, a lot of those new models are made in China. They're very good products from the sounds of things. But still, we should be asking those questions.
Where do you think Pauline Hanson would stand on all of this, and what would she do if she were the Prime Minister? Martin, have you seen that One Nation support has been surging, particularly with women, wealthy people, and city voters, by all accounts, according to the pollsters?
Generally, when your support in the poll surges, sooner or later, after it gets to a certain level, it starts broadening and deepening across the board. Polls have One Nation, the latest polls, there's only been a couple of them that have One Nation, the single highest primary vote now, overtaking Labor. So that's quite an extraordinary result. And it does demonstrate that they're reaching beyond that regional white bloke vote, older bloke vote, into other demographics. And this is starting to become the case. So once they start attracting women and wealthy people and city people, I think we've got a real issue in terms of your two-party system and how well that's going to survive. And if you're talking about the Labor and Liberal and National parties, they'd be quite worried about that, I suspect. Certainly Labor would have been less worried about that previous demographic, more worried about that broadening support.
Well, funnily enough, the headlines just a couple of years ago, as the community independence, the so-called Teals were surging, was pretty much along the lines of Teal support surges with women, wealthy city voters, Martin.
Well, part of the, and we've talked about the appeal of One Nation. There's a lot of frustration, anxiety, particularly economic anxiety, that is happening, in part because of the cost of living, but in part because of the global uncertainty that it's provided. So, looking after ourselves and just thinking about ourselves and our own interests in a more insular way has become more the thing. Now, that's appealing across the board, Michael, I would suggest. And that probably, those sentiments probably lead to a much broader protest vote and dissatisfaction than previously. And I think that's probably where One Nation's been able to pick that up.
Martin, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has seemed pretty much impregnable. He's won a couple of general elections, but you keep hearing grumbles around the place. Do you think, as I've suggested in the past, that Jim Chalmers will be put in the pole position sometime soon before the next election?
Well, it's a bit of an interesting one. He's always been seen as the heir apparent, as an obvious person, and there's been a number of prominent treasurers, Paul Keating no less, that's gone on to become prime minister. A lot of his political future, though, hinges on the reception to the budget, which so far hasn't gone very well. And so he's got a lot of work to sell this and to turn that around. Otherwise, that becomes something that hangs over him too, not just the Prime Minister.
Jim Chalmers might also be called upon to advance and deal with people like Meta, who have declared war on Australia's plan to make it pay for news. You recall that this was a big issue a couple of years ago when Meta actually pulled the plug on Australian news outlets, as they did in Canada and still have done in Canada. In fact, Fremantle Shipping News got banned by Facebook and the rest of the Meta people. It was a great badge of honor at the time. I wish we were still banned by them, but we're not. Have you seen this move? Meta just basically say, we're out there doing our thing. Why should you do this? And, what's our responsibility to pay for public interest journalism in Australia?
Well, I think that the government has got a point here, and I think that there's a real issue that's here. Generally speaking, quality journalism, like any other product, is no different to any other product. Some people can do it for free, and that's fantastic. And we all know that the mighty Fremantle Shipping News is available for free. But for larger, complex outlets employing a lot of people, it's a product that people need to pay for in order to make that sustainable. It's no different to other things. If you then have another entity that then replays or reproduces your content for free, how can that work? It seems to me incongruous. So all that we should expect from our social media outlets is to play by the same rules as the rest of us. And if they're using someone's content, they should pay a price for that. It should be a reasonable price. It should be something negotiated. And if they did that more effectively, I think then everyone would actually benefit.
It really is interesting. We don't hear Google bleating at the moment. And we also are aware that at least some of the Australian news outlets have done deals with the big AI organisations to compromise the copyright, intellectual property right issues that arise in all of this, Martin. I guess we're still in those transitionary days with the way technology works and media operates. And we'll be talking about this in at least 5 years' time still, I think.
Well, I hope that we can resolve this. This could be resolved, in my view, and it should be resolved. And it should be resolved by having you have you cast you make a deal. You come to an agreement. You operate in Australia. You reproduce news. Then here's the terms under which you do it. And a lot of people access news now through social media. That's okay. But if you can find a simple agreement that compensates people appropriately, I think that could work for all parties.
Well, Martin, we've been canvassing news from the international, the regional, the national news in Australia. So we've had some local news here. Local environmentalists have been and people who are sort of protesting at AUKUS had a big right to protest seminar over the last 3 nights in Fremantle. People like Joe Valentine, not a blast from the past, but who was doing all of these things way back in the late 60s and 70s, spoke, and all the new young ones on the trail. And then we've had people sort of occupying some of the ministerial and Labor local member electorate offices recently, complaining about fracking in the Kimberley, Martin. There's a big campaign on to stop fracking in the Kimberley, God's own country up there. And the Premier, Roger Cook, recently sort of threatened, I thought it was a bit strange that he would say this, that if people are going to continue to complain about the Woodside Browse development offshore the Kimberleys to provide more natural gas and keep exceeding Australia's obligations in respect of fossil fuel emissions, then what alternative would they have but to allow fracking in the Kimberleys? Seemed a very blunt statement, Martin. Is that good politics?
Well, the state government here is always dealing with a variety of different demographics, and I think that there's the good burghers of Fremantle, not all, but significant support for maintaining that ban on fracking, and then there will be other people that rely on the mining industry for their jobs. So it's probably balancing up a few of those different prevailing things. But opening up that can of worms is likely to be a bit of a red rag to a bull, because the state government's general position has been that fracking is banned in the Kimberley at the moment. And why is this a big issue? Because that's not going to change. But those comments seem to contradict that. The other thing that's important to remember is every proposal for fracking, and indeed every new operation, has to go before the Minister for Environment to make a determination. It has to also go before the EPA. So you also need to be really careful about preempting a very specific legal process, Michael, around those things.
Wise word, Martin. I gather Pauline Hanson might be in town next week, coming Wednesday, someone told me. Must ask her what she thinks about fracking in the Kimberleys.
I think that would be a really interesting discussion, actually. The one thing that you're going to start to see with Pauline Hanson is a lot more scrutiny about her positions and the positions of One Nation, given that they're potentially a party of government, which has not been the case before. And you can expect to see a lot of that over the next 12 to 24 months, Michael.
One of her major backers, Gina Rinehart, I think, has significant property interests in the Kimberley, Martin.
Well, that's right. And I think that One Nation has flirted with a policy on gas reservation, you might recall. And Pauline Hanson's kind of in line with her comments about sovereignty, has suggested that more needs to be done to reserve gas for Australian consumers. So watch that space. I think that's a really interesting one. And I think there's is she going to outflank the coalition on something like that?
Martin, I have the distinct impression we're not going to run out of things to talk about for the next balance of this year at least. But we'll have to leave some of them until next Friday. It's been great talking to you today.
A pleasure as always.